So we are going to continue our job of patching up the layer model to make it sort of describe the real world. The layer model that you worked on in lab this week is designed to be simple enough that it's very easy, very clear to get our heads around what exactly is happening when you have greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. But as we've started to talk about, there are all kinds of complexities in the real world that are not in the layer model. So ultimately, you know, when they actually predict climate change, they use these huge, well, they're actually not so huge. They use these fairly complicated computer models that take, you know, large amounts of computer time to run. Actually, as it turns out, even though computers are growing more faster and cheaper according to Moore's law, just this amazing explosion of computer power, climate science is one of those issues that is never going to have enough computing power as much as they would like ultimately. So ultimately, these models of climate, of the Earth's climate, get very complicated. But so what we're doing just in these, you know, next few lectures is sort of adding bits and pieces to it, you know, one at a time, to try to understand how the real world is different from that layer model. So we talked about how real gases interact with infrared light, as opposed to the pane of glass in the layer model, which absorbs all the infrared light that it sees and then emits a black body. So in the infrared, the pane of glass is actually considered a black body. If you can imagine a black pane of glass, that's a little weird. But real gases, it turns out, are very choosy about what kind of infrared light they absorb and emit. So the two criteria that must be met if a gas molecule is going to absorb and emit infrared, one is, which you've seen now easily half a dozen times, but I'm a big believer in mind-numbing repetition, so here we go again. The frequency of the vibration of the chemical bond has to equal the frequency of the light. So that's kind of clear. And then the one that was new that we talked about is that the vibration has to perturb the electric field. So because of these requirements, the infrared light that greenhouse gases absorb and emit is very specific. It's at specific wavelengths. It's not a black body. It's very choosy about the light that it absorbs. So if we have the ground and we're looking at infrared going out to space, which is how energy leaves. So this is the eyeball, the infrared eyeball in space, is how energy leaves the planet. So the spectrum in cycles per centimeter of the ground looks like that. And then a pane of glass, which is a black body, is colder than the ground. So the pane of glass would look like that. But if we want to put in something other than the pane of glass, a greenhouse gas, which is choosy about the light that it absorbs and emits, then we get kind of a hybrid of the layer model that sort of has a layer in some frequencies and doesn't have a layer in other frequencies. So we have to divide the light up into two different flavors, one which gets absorbed and another doesn't. So one of these frequencies is the bending vibrational frequency. And so because the CO2 molecule can bend at that frequency, it absorbs and emits. And so in this frequency, it acts like the layer model with a pane of glass there. And then this is a frequency called the atmospheric window. Where there aren't any gases that absorb and emit. So what can absorb and emit in the atmospheric window? Anybody remember anything in the atmosphere besides airplanes? Is there anything that can absorb and emit in the atmospheric window? Any black bodies in the atmosphere? Wake up. Clouds, yes. So clouds could absorb here, but there aren't any gases that absorb in the atmosphere. So a cloud is made of condensed matter, and condensed matter is usually a pretty good black body in almost all cases. But gases are not black bodies. They're very choosy about the light. So in this case, if we have this sort of hybrid, you know, where some of the light is absorbed, but some of it gets a free ride through the atmosphere, the spectrum kind of looks like a hybrid between these two. So if all that was going on was CO2 that absorbed at that frequency, so this is the bend frequency. At the bending frequency, we would see the cold. And at the window frequency, we would see the warm, the ground. And one impact of this there were two things that were important about this. One is that if you decrease the infrared flux out, it makes the temperature of the Earth get warmer. So that's the greenhouse effect. The layer model, if you put in a cold layer there and kept everything the same, you'd have less infrared energy going out than coming in, and so you're not balancing the books. So to balance the books, you've got to warm up the planet in order to make things go, to make things balance. The same way with this greenhouse gas that acts like a layer but only in part of the spectrum, it decreases the amount of energy going out, which is given by the area under the curve. And if you got less energy going out, then you gotta get it back up so that it balances the sun again. And that, to do that, makes you have to make the Earth get warmer. Yes?
What temperature are we looking at?
We're looking at the Earth as a whole, or the ground temperature? Ground temperature. Yeah, so this is another way that the layer model is too simple, is it just has one temperature for the ground, whereas we know that the real world has all different temperatures, and we'll talk about that in a couple of lectures, actually. But for now, we just got one temperature of the ground. It's sort of like an average temperature, I suppose. The other take-home point is this band saturation effect. Where the more CO2 you put into the atmosphere, the more it decreases the amount of energy going out. And as much as it decreases the energy going out, that's how much is going to ultimately have to warm the Earth. So as the intensity of light going out decreases, that means that the planet has to get warmer. It turns out that when there's not very much of the gas, adding a little bit of it has a huge effect on the infrared energy out, because you're starting out with something that's like an atmospheric window where no gases absorb, and then you put in a little bit of gas there and it makes a big difference to the shape of that curve. And then as you get more and more, the bands, this absorption band here kind of reaches saturation. So in the frequencies that are absorbed most strongly, what you see when you look down is the cold part of the atmosphere, and putting more gas there doesn't really change that all that much. So adding more makes that peak get broader without getting any deeper. So the sensitivity to adding more of the gas decreases. So it turns out that CO2 concentration is sort of like here, and so adding some more CO2, say adding that much, changes the energy balance by that much and warms the planet. But methane, which is of course a different molecule, so it absorbs in different, you know, wavelength bands and everything, but still it has a curve sort of like this. Methane, the concentration is much lower. So if you add the same absolute amount of methane, you get a much bigger change in the climate of the Earth, because the bands, the absorption bands for methane are not saturated. And then there are some compounds like freons, which are refrigerants, and something called sulfur hexafluoride, SF6, which had no natural, there was none of this stuff in the natural world. And so that was initially here. And so adding some of that has an even bigger effect. So a little bit of greenhouse gas goes a long way, but as you get more and more, there's kind of a diminishing returns. It turns out, just as sort of a final note on this, that the climate forcing from carbon dioxide itself scales as the logarithm of the CO2 concentration. It's not linear. What that means is that any doubling of the CO2 concentration is equivalent to any other. So if you had 10 parts per million and you increased it to 20, you would get just as much global warming as if you started from 100 and you go to 200, or 1,000 and you go to 2,000. So they talk about a quantity in climate modeling called the climate sensitivity, which is how much does the planet warm up from doubling the CO2 concentration. And that's a convenient thing, because doubling is always the same. It doesn't matter much where you start from. You know, whereas if you were to say the climate sensitivity is how much warming you get by adding 10 parts per million, you'd get much different change in the climate if you start out at a low concentration than a high concentration. Is everybody happy with this band saturation? It doesn't ever, adding more CO2, it never becomes totally insensitive to CO2. So the planet Venus has 70 atmospheres of CO2 in its atmosphere. All of its carbon is in the atmosphere. We'll talk about why that is when we get to the carbon cycle. But adding more CO2 to Venus would make Venus even hotter still. So it never gets to the point where it doesn't matter you add more, but there's this strong effect that the more you have, the less sensitive it is to getting more. Yeah, there's a question. Yes. 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 That's exactly right. So here, this plot. A little bit looks like that. A little more goes like that. And as you add more, that bite that it's taking out is getting deeper. So that's before it's saturated. But then when it starts to reach there, it doesn't get any deeper, really. It sort of spreads out. And so it... when it reaches that cold thing, that's where it's actually saturated.
Can you point out where on the graph we can see through? Like, what do you mean? Like, we can see through from space. What is that?
That's the atmospheric window. And that actually turns out to be sort of in this region here. So it's just a range of frequencies where there don't happen to be any gas molecules that absorb light in that frequency. Actually, that's not totally true. Freons absorb in the atmospheric window. And so that's what makes them so incredibly powerful as a greenhouse gas. Another thing I should show you here is that because of this band saturation effect, one molecule of methane is about equal to maybe 40 molecules of CO2. And one molecule of freon, or sulfur hexafluoride, which are both totally undersaturated, is sort of the equivalent of about 10,000 molecules of CO2, because those are unsaturated. So you'll actually have a chance to prove this one for yourself in lab this next week using that model. Big excitement there, I know. Try not to do it too soon, you don't want to. Yes? What I said is that going from 10 to 20 parts per million of CO2 leads to some change in energy in watts per meter squared. That is about the same, some number of watts per square meter. It must be about 2, I believe, actually. So if you had 10 parts per million and you double it to 20, you get 2 watts per square meter of change in infrared. You can verify this with the model too. If you go from 100 to 200, it's about 2. And 1,000 to 2,000, it's about 2. So if it was a straight line, if it was linear, then 10 ppm added would be the same no matter how much you had. So intensity as a function of CO2, it really looks sort of like this. And so doubling, let's see, a doubling. So from here to here, that is a doubling of the CO2 concentration. And so if I drew this anything close to right, I would get that much change. And then let's say here to here, that's a doubling. So you get that much change. And what this is saying is that those two are the same, as opposed to, say, if it was a straight line, then 100 ppm of CO2 would give you the same climate response no matter how much you started with. So it's sort of a diminishing returns. If you got a lot, then adding more doesn't make as much difference to you as if you're starving for it. OK, so I want to talk now about the real atmosphere, a little bit about the structure of the real atmosphere for the next couple of lectures. So on this sort of layer model cartoon here, I wrote cool here and warm there. And I kind of just pulled those out of the air. But now what we're going to talk about is kind of why the atmosphere has that sort of a temperature structure. So to start out with, we have to understand something about how atmospheric pressure works. So the pressure of a gas, if you hook up a pressure gauge to your bicycle tire and measure the pressure, how much air pressure you have in your bike tires, what you're actually measuring is the force that is felt when some molecule or atom of gas bounces off of the wall. That's what you're actually feeling. Or if you squeeze your bike tire and it's, you know, pretty well inflated, you have to push pretty hard to squeeze it in. What's pushing back against you is gas molecules that are hitting the inside of the tire and exerting a force pushing back. So there are different kinds of gases in the atmosphere. There are big ones and little ones. And if I were, you know, making this stuff up out of my head and I didn't really know any better, I would imagine that you would get more force on the inside of that bike tire from the big molecules than the little ones. So oxygen is heavier than nitrogen gas, for example. I would expect it to matter, you know, which ones have the most punch. I mean, if you're going to throw bowling balls and ping pong balls against the wall, which one is going to, you know, push on the wall more strongly? I would guess it would be the bowling balls. But it turns out that the force that we're looking for is equal to velocity times the mass. And each of these gases, if they're at the same temperature, they're going to have the same amount of thermal energy sort of stored in the flying around of the gas. So the big molecules are going to have 1/2 kT of energy for each of the three dimensions, and the little ones are going to have the same amount of energy on average at the same temperature. So if you take some amount of energy, you know, some number of joules of energy, and you invest that into the motion of these two kinds of atoms, what you get is the little ones are moving much faster than the big ones. Because, you know, to put energy into a ping pong ball, you put the same amount of energy into it, and it's flying a lot faster than if you, you know, so you flick a ping pong ball, it moves quickly. You flick a bowling ball, it moves pretty slow. The same flick for both, right? So it turns out that the pressure that you measure in your bicycle tire or in the atmosphere or wherever doesn't care about big molecules versus little molecules. So my naive guess that the big ones would be contributing more would have been wrong. So the pressure is simply proportional to the number of molecules of the gas. The mass doesn't matter. So one way that we measure concentrations of gas in air, see, it's tricky. Normally, a concentration is the word concentration means the number of molecules per volume. So if you know, measure some salt into your water that you're going to boil pasta in, you've got a couple liters of water and you teaspoon of salt in that, it's sort of like salt per volume of water is how you do that. And that's convenient for water because water, it doesn't expand or contract. Gases are tricky because they expand to fill whatever container they're in. So you have gas, you know, at atmospheric pressure, that's got a different number of molecules total per volume than if you fly up in an airplane or climb up Mount Everest or something and see how many molecules there are per volume there. So for gases, but gases expand. And so molecules per volume is just a crummy way of thinking about how much of a gas there is. So for gases, they use something called a mixing ratio, which sounds kind of obtuse and hard to understand, but it's just the number of molecules of say CO2 divided by the number of molecules total. So that way, if the pressure changes and the gas expands or contracts or something, it doesn't change what you're calling the amount of CO2, because it all goes sort of together. So a lot of times, CO2 is represented as parts per million, which is just a way of making a little number into a bigger number that's easier to understand. So ppm, parts per million, is the number of CO2 molecules per million total molecules. And the atmosphere today is about 285 parts per million, and it's growing at about 2 parts per million every year. Yes. 10 to the 6th, yeah, so million. So because the pressure exerted by the CO2 is just a function of numbers of molecules, and we don't have to worry. Actually, CO2, because it's got 3 atoms, is a lot heavier than nitrogen or oxygen. But we don't have to worry about that. We can forget about that and just count the molecules. It turns out that what they call the partial pressure, so the pressure that's just coming from the CO2 molecules bouncing off the pressure gauge on your bicycle tire, it's directly related to this, the mixing ratio in parts per million. It's actually 285 micro atmospheres is what the pressure gauge on your tire pump would say if it was only listening to the CO2. So micro atmospheres, 285 times 10 to the minus 6 atmospheres of pressure, where 1 atmosphere of pressure is the total pressure here at the ground. So you just take the total pressure and divide, multiply it by whatever fraction of the CO2 you're looking for, and that's the pressure that comes from that gas. Yes? Well, this works for other gases too. I'm just, got CO2 on the brain because that's what I do for a living. But you could do the same thing for nitrogen. Nitrogen is 80% of the atmosphere. So you could say the mixing ratio of nitrogen gas is 0.8. And then the partial pressure of nitrogen gas would be 0.8 atmospheres. So it all works. Yes? Partial pressure is the fraction of the total pressure that comes from a given gas. So the tire pressure gauge, if we just had a pressure gauge in here, it would measure 1 atmosphere pressure, more or less. And we could break that down. So 0.8 atmospheres comes from nitrogen, and 0.2 comes from oxygen, and 0.03% of that comes from CO2. You could add up the different pieces, and they would add up to the total pressure. It breaks down kind of in a nice, very convenient way like that. All you got to do is count the molecules, and you got the answer. It could be a lot more complicated, I would have thought, but it's not. Yes?
Can you please give the example of what gas is?
That is the Boltzmann constant. It's just a number. You don't have to remember exactly, you know, what its value is, but it's just a constant number. So the point is that at a given temperature, the energy of the flying around, the heat energy, is directly just proportional to the temperature, just some constant times the temperature. And then this 1/2 has been sort of dangling here in a kind of, you know, what the hell is that? But it's just a constant. Just think of it as a number that's not changing as we, you know, think about different oscillators or different molecules or whatever. It's just always a constant times the temperature. Okay, so the atmospheric pressure that we feel on the ground is caused by the weight of the gases over our heads. You don't think about gas as having mass, or that, you know, we're under this burden of all this stuff kind of pushing down on us, but it's there. So the simplest way to think about how pressure changes as a function of altitude in the atmosphere is to first start with a simpler case, which is water, which is not compressible. So in water, if we were to make a plot of the pressure as a function of depth in the water, each time you swim down, say 10 meters, the pressure goes up one atmosphere. So if there's one atmosphere here, pressure and this is 10 meters, 20 meters. Each time you swim down 10 more meters, which is about 30 feet, you have put about the same amount of mass over your head, and so the pressure increases in a straight line as you swim down. So when you swim down a meter up near the top, you leave behind just as much water as if you're down 100 meters and you swim down one more meter. Probably a bad idea if you're scuba diving that deep, but because the water is not compressible. So a meter of depth is the same no matter where you are. Every time you swim down 1 meter, you leave behind certain mass of stuff over your head, and so the pressure increases because you've added that much to the stuff that's on top of you. So it goes as a straight line like this. For the atmosphere, because gas is compressible, it's kind of more complicated. And the way to think of it is as if, or at least one way to think of it, not the way to think of it certainly, but one way, is to imagine building a wall out of bricks that are sort of springy. They can compress. So ordinary bricks, they don't compress. They just, you pile them up and they might break, but they never squeeze, they never squish. But these are special bricks that sort of squish. And so here's one, it's at the bottom, and the spring is all squished up. And then here's another one on top of it, and it's got less stuff under it. And so it's thicker. Like that. So at the very top brick has nothing over it, and so it's all expanded. And then as you get farther and farther down that wall, the bricks are getting closer, they're getting smaller. So if you were to be Batman and walk, there's his cape, and he's walking up the wall. They always did this really cheesy thing, you know, it was obvious they were walking and then turned the camera sideways. It was great. You're probably really sorry you missed the 60s. So there's Batman walking up the wall, and he takes a step. When he takes a step at the bottom of the wall, he passes a whole brick because that brick is squished down. So when you pass a whole brick, you change the number of bricks over above you, and so translating back into the pressure analogy here, you are leaving below you lots of the gas. So there's a pretty big temperature or pressure change when you do that first sort of a step. But when you are up here, when Batman is up here, and he takes one step, he's not leaving as much brick underneath him anymore because the bricks have expanded. It's like the air in higher altitude is expanded. And so the way pressure changes in the atmosphere is kind of like that. It's a curve. Let me draw this a little better. It's sort of hard to see the distinction. So whereas the pressure when you swim down in water, it varies linearly with depth because the water is not compressible. In gas, as you climb up a mountain, as you get higher and higher, the gas is expanded. So when you climb a meter at the top of Mount Everest, you don't leave as much gas below you as if you climb a meter at sea level. And so the pressure change is smaller. So here's 1 meter at sea level. Here's 1 meter at the top of Mount Everest. And the change in pressure here is much smaller than the change in pressure down here. It turns out that this funk follows an exponential function. So the pressure at some altitude is equal to the pressure at the ground times a particular number, which is called E. So E has a value of 2.717 with lots and lots of, infinite number of decimal places. So E raised to the power of the height divided by some constant. So one implication of this is that you can never make this number E raised to, even if you put a very, very high altitude here, like, the altitude of the moon or something. You put a huge number into there, E to the minus huge number gets very, very close to zero, but it never actually equals zero mathematically. So according to this formulation, the atmosphere of the Earth continues forever, only it just gets very, very, very tenuous and thin when you get high enough up. So that's kind of a curiosity. But I wanted to finish out our time today just talking about this exponential function, because it comes up just absolutely all the time in earth sciences. Yes? Yes, E to the... So z is a height in meters, and then it's divided by some other height in meters. Yeah, actually, it turns out that the height in meters, this h0 is sort of like there. It's where the pressure has decreased about two-thirds of the way toward zero. It's called the scale height of the atmosphere. One thing, it has to be in the same units as z, because if you raise a number to some power, there can't be any units in the exponent. You can't raise 10 to the power of 3 oranges or something like that. It doesn't make sense. You can raise it to the power of 3. So you got to have the meters go away by dividing by meters there. And another curiosity is that, so this scale height is about 8 kilometers in the atmosphere. So Mount Everest is higher than that. So Mount Everest is, you know, getting to be pretty low pressure there for sure. That 8 kilometers is kind of another way of talking about the height of the atmosphere. Doing it by where it actually goes to zero doesn't work because it never goes to zero mathematically. But if you were to take all of the gas in the air and make it all have the same, if it was not expandable, if it was all just like what we have here at the ground and it wouldn't expand with lower pressure, it would be 8 kilometers high. So that's kind of like, you know, the height of the atmosphere in some sense. So this exponential function, e to the x or e to the minus x, comes up all the time in the natural sciences and financial, you know, all kinds of things. It was invented by bankers to do compound interest. So say you have an interest rate of 10% per year and you've got a bank account that has $100 in it. After 1 year, if you just calculate the interest once, at the end of the year, you got $100, but then you get 10%, it would go to $110. But there's a trick. You can do what's called compounding the interest more often than once a year. So you can go for 6 months, $100. So this is now 1 year. We're going to go 6 months. And you're going to have $105. And then we're going to do another 6 months. And you will get, because you're now earning interest on this $5, you're getting $110.25 at the end of a year if you compound it twice. So, you know, people were saying, well, this is not fair. How about I make you compound it every second? You know, that's, you'll get more money that way at the end of the year. And it's a lot of work for the bankers to do that. So they invented this function where if you compound continuously, you get this kind of curve. And it turns out that it's an exponential curve. So now the balance at some time in the future is equal to the initial balance times e raised now to the plus exponent of time times 10% per year. So that's if you compound, you know, continuously, every second, every microsecond, every millisecond, all the time, the highest. So compounding once, you got this, twice, you got that. You do it continuously using this exponential function, you end up with $110.52 is what you would get if you did that, you know, every continuously, either with lots of little steps like this, it would approximate it, or using the exponential function would get it. The reason why the exponential function comes up so much is because the rate of change depends on the current sort of amount. So in the bank account, the rate of change of the bank account is how much interest you're making every second or month or year or something like that. And that depends on how much money you have there. You put $1,000 there, you'll earn more interest than if you have $100 there. There are other cases that other situations where the rate of change depends on the quantity of interest. One of them is population. Where the number of new babies that you get every year depends on the number of potential mommies and daddies you have to make the new babies. So you have a big population, the growth rate in the number of new people per year will be higher than if you have a small population. So the growth rate depends on the population. Radioactive decay is another example. The number of counts you get from a Geiger counter from a lump of uranium depends on how big the lump of uranium is. If it's smaller, you get fewer. If it's bigger, you get more. And it turns out that pressure in the atmosphere does this too. Although it's not quite as easy to see, the change in pressure with height, how the pressure changes as you go up 1 meter of altitude climbing up Mount Everest, depends on the number of molecules per volume, the density of the gas, and the density of gas, which depends on pressure. So, I think we have just enough time for a quick eye clicker. So, a series of phenomena, and we're supposed to guess whether we think they will follow an exponential trajectory or not. Either exponential growth, like population growth, or exponential decay, like radioactive decay, or the change in pressure with altitude in the atmosphere is exponential decay. So economic activity, what do we think? Is that going to be an exponential curve or something else? It turns out that economic growth does follow an exponential curve. And it's because the more stuff, more factories you have, the more economic activity there is, the faster it can grow. So in terms of the number of new factories per year, a big country is going to make more new factories per year than a small country would. So here's another one. Popping popcorn. What do you think? Could it possibly be, or am I throwing you a red herring? You're good. You don't buy it. Yeah, popping popcorn is sort of more like a Gaussian. So the rate of pops per time is sort of more like a bell curve, probably. It doesn't, I suppose you could say if you had more kernels in there, they would be popping more quickly. But it's not like the popped kernels are the ones that, I don't know. Yeah, so I wouldn't expect that to be an exponential curve, but a different kind of curve, the Gaussian that comes up all the time also in science. Water temperature on an electric burner on a stove. You turn on the stove and you've got a pot of water there, and there's some rate of energy flow into the water that's given by watts of energy, probably joules per second, that are going into the water. Do we think that will be exponential? I would say it would not be exponential. I would expect the water temperature to go up sort of linearly with time until it reaches boiling, and then it would stay at the boiling temperature till it runs dry. Temperature of frozen food in a microwave. You try to defrost something in a microwave. Well, you know just by psychology that I have to throw you the different answer from last time. Actually, as it turns out, the food in a microwave oven, the microwaves are absorbed by the liquid water. So if you put a chunk of like really frozen stuff in there, it warms up pretty slowly until you start getting some liquid water, and then the liquid water absorbs more and more heat, and so it goes kind of nuts. And so I would say that is more like an exponential. What about the enrollment in global warming class? I'll show you this. This is amazing. This is the enrollment in this class through the last 10 years that I've been doing it. And this is an exponential growth curve. So I don't know what that means. I'm doomed. OK, I'll see you on Monday.